Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Yes, it is time for Dear Science. How are you, Ellen?
I'm very well, Lillian, as usual.
As usual. Always good. Always good.
Well, you know, it's the last week of lectures.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, all so right, that's, yeah, that's got to be a good thing. Yeah. We'll for the students and for, yeah, anyway. Yeah.
For everyone.
Yeah.
We'll get into it. All right. Nobel Prize in Chemistry.
Absolutely.
For the world's most powerful battery.
Well, you know, this is the biggest story of the year, which it always is because it's the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, you know. So. Anyway, to cut a long story short, these guys, John B. Goodenough, M. Stanley Whittingham, and Akira Yoshino, got it for lithium-ion batteries, basically, which is something that everybody has heard of, I guess.
And this electric vehicles.
Yeah. They do indeed, and every damn thing on the planet, basically. So any sort of rechargeable battery these days is a lithium-ion battery,
gotcha,
which is fantastic. And this is one of the rare sort of Nobel Prizes that people can probably relate to in terms of chemistry, because normally, well, often, they're very, very, very sort of highly academic sort of stuff.
Completely above my head.
That is of interest to very, very few in the world. But this should be of interest to very, very many. And it's all to do with batteries. And so batteries started in 1800, way back in the day. A man by the name of Volta. And what he did was take a whole lot of plates of copper and zinc, and he sort of interlaced them alternately and put bits of cloth that had been soaked in brine between them. And that was the electrolyte. And so that was the world's first battery. Not particularly practical, but demonstrated the fact that you could store energy, basically, because that's what a battery is. It essentially stores electricity for later use. And that's kind of important in these days.
So today, we really like our batteries.
We do. And so there was a whole lot of development of batteries and stuff like that. And then in around 1859, the lead acid battery was formed.
Yes.
And we are still using that today in our cars.
Okay.
So this was a mixture of lead and lead dioxide and sulfuric acid, basically. Now, what's the problem with lead? Number one, it's a bit nasty.
Poisonous, isn't it?
Bit poisonous.
Yes.
And number two, it's very, very dense. So as you would know, if you've ever lifted up a car battery when it's gone flat, it's a hell of a weight in there. Okay, now the reason that they used lead acid batteries was because they're very efficient. So a lead acid battery gives you about 2 volts per cell, and so therefore your normal sort of 12 volt car battery is 6 cells.
Gotcha. Okay?
Right, so, and it's rechargeable and everything, you know, so that's nice. And then you had things like your nickel cadmium, which is not great because it's got cadmium in it, and nickel metal hydride.
Just had no idea okay. There was this many batteries.
Oh, shit, I could talk all day, but you don't want me to, so I'm not going to. Okay. So anyway, the point being, right, what humanity wanted was something that was lighter.
Okay.
Okay.
And
because
still long-lasting and
light, long-lasting, high voltage, etc., etc., etc. So, what these three guys did in the 1970s, this Stanley Whittingham, he came up with an idea for the cathode of a battery. Okay. So you've got a cathode and an anode in a battery. You've got two ends of the battery, shall we say.
Yep. And one end of it, the positive and the negative.
Oh, there we go. Yes. And he came up with a new material that worked really, really well for this. And he also used lithium metal in his battery as well, because he realized that lithium's really light. Lithium's the lightest metal on the periodic table, for those of you who've been listening to a certain podcast, you know. So very, very, very light. But in terms of wanting to give up electrons, which is what you want in an electric current, this is really, really good stuff.
So, brilliant.
But trouble is, it reacts with water, gives off hydrogen, goes bang.
Okay, problem when it rains.
Indeed. So he found this new material to make the cathode, but he was still using lithium as his anode. So that was sort of part of the way to a solution of the problem. And then Goodenough, what a great name, Goodenough, he came along and made an even better cathode. So he was getting 4 volts out of this battery that he was using lithium with, which is brilliant, okay? And then Yoshino came along and he found that you didn't have to use lithium at all. And you could use essentially what is graphite with lithium ions in there. Okay, and a lithium ion is what happens when you take a lithium atom and you take an electron away from it.
Okay.
And that all of a sudden made everything really, really a hell of a lot safer because you don't use lithium metal in them anymore. You're using lithium ions in this graphite sort of thing, and the battery just worked brilliantly. So
amazing.
You had high voltage and you have lightweight and you have rechargeable, which has changed the planet, basically.
And well-deserved for the Nobel Prize. Oh,
well, the thing was that, John Goodenough, he's 97 years old, so he's the oldest ever Nobel laureate, and he has been on the sort of the Nobel Prize radar for the past, 10 years or so, really. And every year he misses out, you know, everyone's saying, oh, God, it's too late, he's not going to make the next one, et cetera, but at the ripe old age of 97,
he's got it.
The committee decided that it was his time.
All right.
And it's absolutely fantastic. So there you go, something that everybody's heard of, and the importance of it cannot be overstated because of the fact that, you know, we need green energy, we need solar power, we need to be able to store it. Lithium-ion batteries can do that. Having said that, lithium's not the most abundant element on the planet.
Okay.
And
something
so people are now looking at aluminium. Using aluminium in place, very possibly, of lithium, because aluminium, it's not as light, but it's still light, but it's a hell of a sight more abundant than lithium. So,
all right.
You know, watch this space.
Watch this space,
more
and you can explain more about aluminium, perhaps. More research is required. That should be another thing.
As it always. That's what we should call the
that's
show.
Right. Yeah. Should be the segment. Okay, so there is also, let's do the next story, I think, quickly. Let's go through this one.
Quickly.
We've just got a big show today, that's all.
I know.
So Saturn's many moons. Now, I've said that because it used to have less moons, now it has more moons.
It does indeed. So when I was a kid, Mercury had zero, Venus had zero, the Earth had one, Mars had two, Jupiter had 12, Saturn had 9, Uranus had 5, Neptune had 2.
Great memory, okay.
And Pluto had none. And now, as a result of last week, the Earth's still got one, Mars has got two, but Jupiter now has got 79 and Saturn has got 82, so it's winner. So they have just announced the discovery of 20 new moons.
They just
for
found
Saturn.
20 more.
They did.
All together?
Yes.
Around each other?
All over the show, basically. So they got onto this big old telescope on top of Mauna Kea in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. And
disputed. Just putting that out there. It's a dispute going on there.
And so they found another 20 of these tiny, tiny moons. So they've got radii all less than, say, 10 kilometres. So they're really tiny, tiny moons. Mm. But they are undoubtedly moons of Jupiter. So there you go. Saturn. So Saturn is now the winner for the most number of
moons. Who knew
moons
there was a competition?
With 82. Well, speaking of competition, if I may, do you want to name some of these moons?
No.
You don't?
No.
You wouldn't want to?
Let's
there
get
is
people
a competition.
To text in.
There is
There's a competition.
No,
where?
Literally, there is a competition. You go to carnegiescience.edu and you'll see that there's an online competition to be able to name these moons.
Well, Will's going to have a go.
The corollary being that they have got to be from either Norse or Gaelic or Inuit mythology, because all of the other moons are named from those mythologies. Okay. So if you want to make yourself, you know, famous.
Oh, you get to pick.
Yes, that's what
right.
I'm saying. You get to name the moon. So as long as you come up with a name from these mythologies.
We're supposed to list ones that we already knew.
No.
What about Lillian?
Is that from Norse or Gaelic or Inuit mythology?
All right, well, let's go on to the next topic. All right, now walking is really good for you.
Well, it's not so much that walking is good for you, it's how fast you walk.
Okay.
That's the important thing, okay? So, as a result of the good old Dunedin study, for those of you who don't know, basically every baby, I think, born in Dunedin between April 1972 and March 1973 was basically signed up to this.
Whoa.
And they have been tracked for their entire lives. So there's 1,037, I think, participants in this study. And every facet of their life has been
documented.
Did they
even know?
Well,
were they
probably
cool
not when
this?
They were young, but yeah.
Were they able to decide, actually, I don't want to be part of this?
Well,
when they
can do, and a few people have dropped out, but not many.
Yeah.
You know, and so this is a really, really big study, you know, worldwide. And so as a result of this study, what has now been shown is that if you walk slowly at the age of 45, you're not in pretty good nick, basically. So what they found, that the slower walkers have got poorer lungs, they've got poorer teeth, and they've got poorer immune systems than those people who walk rapidly, okay? Now, or more rapidly. So it's been known, this is the fact, that people in their 70s and 80s, if they walk more slowly than the others, then their chances of dying are greater. So mm-hmm. people who walk more slowly at that age have been shown to have shorter lifespans. But what this study now has shown is that, you know, even at the age of 45, it's basically being shown that if you walk more slowly than your cohorts, it ain't good. And you're probably heading for an earlier demise wow. than them.
So set the precedent now. Start walking faster.
Well, and there's the really, really interesting thing, is that they reckon, the authors of the study, so they did cognitive tests of these kids when they were age 3, and they reckon that on the basis of those cognitive tests that they did at age 3, they could predict what their walking speed was going to be at the age of 45.
Wow.
That is seriously wow. Okay,
yep,
so that's basically saying that you're screwed at the age of 3.
Good luck. What? Now, there was a question, though, that came up this morning when I was talking about this, and is it, if somebody who has, you know, they're maybe shorter than a taller person, right? So shorter, taller person.
Yeah.
Shorter person has to do more steps, right, in terms of getting somewhere as opposed to the taller person.
Yes.
It's not necessarily about that, right? That was my conclusion, that actually if the shorter person is still walking at a fast pace for themselves, even if they take longer to get... Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So it's your actual velocity. It's not the fact the number of steps you've got to take or anything like that. It's the actual velocity, seemingly.
Brilliant.
From what I understand of the study. So I guess the moral of the story is... start walking. You know, as I walked here today from across the road at AUT, and I made sure I walked pretty damn
really
fast. So, yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Alan. We'll leave it there for today.
Okay, not a problem.
See you in a couple of weeks.
Okay, see ya.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Kim Gordon's new